County, and I had learned a bit about the problems in that county. But I think that now the students are convinced that they can bring about change, and I wouldn't be surprised if they were not at the forefront of an effort to guarantee that the students who attend public schools in that county read the works of Toni Morrison.
Well, we're going to do part two of our conversation, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. And also at democracynow.org, we're going to link to this whole remarkable history-making event that took place last night, Thursday night, in Rockland County. Angela Davis could not be silenced. Angela Davis, the world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, and distinguished professor emerita at University of California, Santa Cruz. Her autobiography has just been published by Haymarket. She'll be speaking at BAM tonight on that autobiography. And Nikki Hines, NIAC and NAACP president, community activist in Rockland County. A happy early birthday to Emily Gosselin, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeitberg, Dina Gosder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, continuing Saturday, December 10th, with the Winter Dance Celtic Christmas Celebration from the New World String Project. The folk music series features Celtic seasonal favorites plus new holiday music with a Nordic twist, with two members of Molly's Revenge and Irish Dancers. Saturday, December 10th at 7:30 in the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. The concert series continues through May. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Coming up now, your KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Membership Drive edition of the KABU Evening News, Multnomah County health officials ask residents to mask up to protect kids from respiratory illnesses.
The Portland Thorns are up for sale.
And in national news, employment numbers come back strong despite inflation.
Good evening, this is the KABU Evening News for Friday, December 2nd, 2022. KABU is currently in our end of year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Annette Newell. Multnomah County and hospital officials are asking local people to mask up through the end of the year to help prevent transmitting respiratory system viruses, including RSV, RSV is especially dangerous for young children under 5. After 2 years of pandemic precautions, people's natural immunities for RSV and the flu are low. In the Tri-County area, there's been the highest rate of pediatric hospitalizations for RSV for the past 5 years. Hospitals say they're operating at crisis capacity already. This means they are assigning more patients than normal to doctors and nurses, and they can ration care. County health officials say they aren't at that stage just yet, but the health system is seriously strained. Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines said, quote, "We've used the word unprecedented a lot in the last 3 years, so it's hard to know how to ratchet that up. We are at what people are calling an historical moment," end of quote. County officials are asking Multnomah County residents to wear masks indoors through January the 1st to help stem the tide of respiratory virus infections and hospitalizations. They also recommend getting vaccinated, washing hands often, and staying home when you're sick.
Hospitals, schools, and vulnerable Americans are grappling with a triple whammy of respiratory viruses this winter: the flu, COVID, and RSV. Health experts break down how RSV affects young children and offer best practices to prevent illness. Nadia Romligon has more in Kentucky.
The flu, COVID, and RSV are rapidly spreading in Kentucky, and health experts say that's a problem for hospitals, schools, and the state's vulnerable residents. So far, more than 20 school districts have temporarily halted classes due to RSV. At Norton Children's Hospital, Dr. Robert Blair says respiratory viruses spread primarily by airborne droplets from coughing and sneezing. He explains premature babies and young children with congenital heart disease, reactive airway disease, or asthma are particularly susceptible to RSV. They can wind up in the hospital on a ventilator, so he encourages families to do everything they can to stop the spread of the virus.
We need to pay attention to people who are sick and isolate them and support them and encourage them to mask and take care of themselves and get medical care. And these little babies that are very, very high risk need to not be exposed to people with colds.
The American Academy of Pediatrics and Children's Hospital Association has asked President Joe Biden to declare a federal emergency to provide more support to combat the nationwide surge in pediatric hospitalizations driven by RSV and the flu. Blair says normally newborns' immune systems come into contact with RSV, but he points out that babies born during the pandemic lockdowns didn't have that exposure.
And so here they are, 2 or 2.5 or 3 years old, and they're catching these virus infections for the very first time, and their immune systems have not really been primed well.
Kelly Talby with Kentucky Voices for Health adds that COVID precautions can help stop the spread of all viruses.
Emphasis on hand washing, social distancing, covering your cough, staying home when you're sick, even if it just seems like mild cold-like symptoms. As we've seen, a lot of those precautions lapsing, those public health policies that were in place during the pandemic early on, we've seen a surge of all of these diseases, and RSV is among them.
There currently is no FDA-approved vaccine for RSV, although clinical trials are ongoing. But Talby says flu shots are easily accessible in every county and are effective at preventing illness, especially among young children, people 65 and older, or those at risk for serious complications. This is Nadia Romligon for Kentucky News Connection.
The owner of the Portland Thorns will sell the professional women's soccer team after pressure from fans and a misconduct investigation. Mayor Paulson is the owner who announced he would sell the soccer club on Thursday. Paulson was included in a wide-ranging systemic abuse investigation into the National Women's Soccer League. He allegedly helped shield former head coach Paul Riley from accountability from sexually harassing a player and helped him find a new coaching job in the league. Thorns captain Becky Sauerbrunn said of the report, quote, "It's my opinion that every owner and executive and U.S. soccer official who have repeatedly failed the players and failed to protect the players, who have hidden behind legalities and have not participated fully in these investigations, should be gone." Fans have been pressuring Paulson to sell, and he has agreed, but with no set timeline. Paulson also promised $1 million to set up a new player safety office for the league. The Thorns could sell for between $30 and $50 million, and at least a few potential buyers have showed interest. Paulson will still own the Timbers and be part of the owners group at Providence Park. Paulson wrote in a statement, quote, "I am fully committed to doing all that is necessary to ensure a smooth transition and the continued success of the Thorns, including providing favorable usage terms for Providence Park that will enable the Thorns to continue to capitalize on their popularity in Portland."
Portland Thorns head coach Rianne Wilkinson resigned her position this month. Wilkinson was hired in November 2021, and in her first season as head coach, took the team to the 2022 National Women's Soccer League Championship. Wilkinson said in a statement, quote, "During my time as the Thorns coach, a player and I formed a friendship that turned into more complex emotions. In mid-October, the player shared her feelings for me, and I reciprocated. While this was a human moment, it went no further than this expression of feelings for one another," end quote. Wilkinson says afterwards they stopped communication and she reported herself to human resources. The Soccer League and the Players Association jointly investigated the head coach and cleared her of any wrongdoing. Wilkinson is not barred from working in the league in the future.
Multnomah County leaders have voted to ban the sale of flavored tobacco products like mentholated cigarettes, e-cigarettes, hookah products, and other flavored nicotine products. This is despite the fact that a similar ban was overturned in Washington County in September. The judge in that case reasoned that a ban like that would have to come from the state level. Leaders have pointed to studies that show flavored e-cigarettes were the most commonly used tobacco product for middle and high school students. They also pointed to other studies that show that policies like a ban on flavored tobacco products have been effective in other places by keeping young people from becoming addicted to nicotine. Public Health Director Jessica Guernsey points out that tobacco companies market their mentholated and flavored products specifically to Black, Latinx, and Native American residents. Guernsey says, quote, "The restricted sale of flavored tobacco, including menthol, directly ties into what it means to address racism as a public health crisis," end of quote. The ban will not punish people for using flavored tobacco products. Since it's a public health law, it will be up to public health officers to enforce the ban by monitoring retail sales and holding shopkeepers accountable if they sell the banned products.
The Senate passes a bill forcing a labor agreement in an effort to avoid a costly railway worker strike. The House Ways and Means Committee has former President Trump's tax returns in hand. And the Agricultural Committee is looking at possible regulations for cryptocurrency following the collapse of cryptocurrency giant FTX. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Workers who do difficult and dangerous work have zero paid sick days. Zero. You get sick, you got a mark against you, a couple of marks, you get fired.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was one of many progressives that were wanting to grant railway workers 7 days of sick leave amid the threat of a national rail strike that would cost billions of dollars per day and induce various supply chain complications across the country. On Thursday, the amendment failed to pick up the support it needed on the Senate floor. In an 80-15 vote, the Senate did pass a labor agreement in an effort to avoid the fast-approaching railroad strike. The bill, now headed to President Joe Biden's desk, aims to implement the agreement that was reached earlier this year between railroad managers and their workers and would take the fast-approaching strike off the table.
I think the public has a right to know. That's why we should pass legislation requiring candidates to do that. That's why every other candidate has, except you know who, and who shall remain nameless here.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi expressed her hopefulness for the public to get to see former President Donald Trump's tax returns, but says the decision will ultimately be up to the House and Ways Committee, which now has its hands on the documents. The prolonged battle for Trump's taxes comes shortly after the Supreme Court denied Trump's request to block the release of his taxes last month. A hearing was held in the Senate Agriculture Committee to discuss the collapse of crypto giant FTX. The Agriculture Committee has overseen commodity trading, which now includes some forms of cryptocurrencies. As a result, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission reports to the Ag Committee. CFTC Chair Rostin Benham testified on the collapse of FTX and is sparking debate on how digital currencies should be regulated.
Really, this goes to the point of a lack of regulation and a lack of insight into FTX and what was happening within the entity and whether or not anyone was identifying these issues.
The Supreme Court agreed to hear arguments and review the legality of Biden's student debt relief program next year. Biden's program would cancel federal student loan debt for millions across the country. The court's decision means debt forgiveness will remain blocked until then. Presidential hopeful Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, sat down in an interview with right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. In the interview, Ye demonstrated his admiration for Adolf Hitler and denied the Holocaust ever happened. Following the interview, several GOP figures condemned Ye's anti-Semitic comments. A Twitter account representing the House Judiciary Committee's Republican members deleted a tweet that seemed to praise the celebrity from earlier this year that read, Kanye, Elon, Trump.
Every human being has something of value that they brought to the table, especially Hitler.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our HRS indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's American Indian Airwaves. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Today's weather will be cloudy with some rain showers and an overnight low down to a chilly 32 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, partly sunny, a high of 43. Today in history, in 2001, Enron, a company that would become synonymous with fraud, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And our quote of the day is from Cuban-born American actor Desi Arnaz, who passed on this day in 1986. He said, quote, "I don't think anyone can tell you what it is that makes you a star."
Despite high inflation, the United States added 263,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate stayed near a 53-year low at 3.7%. Since businesses are struggling to find enough people to fill jobs, they are offering higher pay to attract and keep workers. The average hourly pay jumped about 5% in November. That's compared to this time a year ago. While that is seemingly good news, it does complicate the Federal Reserve's efforts to slow inflation. Some experts now predict the Fed may keep rates high, even longer than previously predicted. The stock market reacted to the employment news, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping more than 400 points as trading opened this morning. This week, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell stated jobs and wages were growing too fast for the central bank to quickly slow inflation. It has raised its benchmark rate from near zero in March to nearly 4%. The Fed's usual target rate for inflation is 2%. More than half the job growth last month came from two industries, education and healthcare, and a category comprised mostly of restaurants, hotels, and entertainment companies.
Many sectors are still replacing workers who were lost during the pandemic, and most other industries have surpassed their pre-pandemic employment levels. A category that includes technology workers actually added jobs, despite several recent high-profile layoffs by tech companies like Amazon, Meta, Twitter, and Redfin. But the new figure still demonstrated some signs of weakness. Retailers, transportation companies, and warehousing firms all cut jobs, as did some temporary staffing agencies. Some signs of modest cooling in the job market have emerged recently. This includes a small decline in job postings and a drop in the number of people who are quitting jobs, trends that suggest some workers are being cautious. Steady hiring and rising paychecks have helped the U.S. economy. In October, consumer spending rose even when you adjust for inflation. The U.S. economy expanded nearly 3% last quarter after shrinking during the first 6 months of the year. There are still some signs of weakness that have sparked concerns about a possible recession next year. Many fear that the Fed's rapidly rising rate hikes will ultimately hurt the economy.
The Bureau of Land Management has proposed a rule that would limit methane flaring on public lands. Eric Tegetthoff has more.
The Biden administration has proposed a rule to limit methane flaring from oil and gas development on public lands. The rule would impose royalty payments for excessive flaring, and the Bureau of Land Management estimates it would generate nearly $40 million a year. Melissa Hornbein, a senior attorney based in Montana with the Western Environmental Law Center, says she's encouraged by some aspects of the proposal, but she believes an outright ban would be more effective as long as there are no safety concerns in a given situation.
There's really no need for it, and instituting a pay-to-play system is not likely to be effective in terms of really reducing the waste of associated gas through venting and flaring.
Hornbein says it's important that the BLM has recognized its authority to regulate such oil and gas waste as methane, and her organization would like to see the agency go further to create a consistent and durable rule that will last into the next administration. A spokesperson for the Independent Petroleum Association of America says the regulations should be handled by the Environmental Protection Agency because the BLM doesn't have enough expertise on this issue. Hornbein notes methane from oil and gas development has negative health impacts on nearby communities. She says that's one reason this type of waste should be regulated closely. The other is the greenhouse gas effects. Methane is 84 times more potent than carbon dioxide, although it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. Hornbein says keeping more methane from reaching the atmosphere would be good for the planet.
In terms of tackling climate change, we're at a point where we're so far down the road, we kind of need to pull out all the stops, and methane really represents the low-hanging fruit for doing that.
A comment period has opened for the rule through January 30th. Hornbein says environmental organizations like hers and the oil and gas industry will comment on the rule, but it's important for the public to get involved as well.
What really means the most and carries the most impact to federal agencies, and I don't think BLM is any exception to this, is hearing from individual members of the public what they want to see in terms of how BLM is regulating oil and gas development on their public lands.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Vice President Kamala Harris has vowed to protect the Indian Child Welfare Act as its fate lies before the Supreme Court. With that story more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with the National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Vice President Kamala Harris vowed to fight to protect the Indian Child Welfare Act. Harris discussed ICWA in remarks at the White House Tribal Nations Summit, which was held this week in Washington, D.C. She says she has a long-standing history of fighting for the principles of ICWA, pointing to her work as an attorney and now as vice president. Harris says she's fully aware of the essential protection ICWA provides.
And back to my time doing that work as an attorney representing children and families in San Francisco and working on ICWA cases, to my time as Attorney General of California and partnering with tribal leaders and child welfare agencies and law enforcement officials to enforce ICWA. I will tell you, as I stand here as Vice President, that President Biden and I remain determined to work with you, with Native leaders, to safeguard the protections of ICWA.
Summit attendee Monique Baker, governance administrator for the tribal government of St. Paul, Alaska, says she feels comforted the White House is acknowledging the challenges tribal families face.
It gives me comfort to know we have someone like Vice President Harris in this position who not only acknowledges what tribal families went through, Native children being torn away from their families and the trauma they endured, and knowing that something is being done to make sure this will never happen again. It's truly amazing to hear all this during the summit this year. I look forward to hearing more next year.
Harris made the comments about ICWA as challenges to the decades-old law intended to keep Native children with Native families was recently heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. On Thursday, tribal leaders and top federal officials hosted a number of panels at the summit, including on health care. Baker says she's interested in information and discussions about extending health care after childbirth. Baker says providing postpartum care, including depression screenings, is a huge step in the right direction for Native families.
That means so much for all Native women. I mean, as a mother myself, I wish I had that coverage. I wish I knew more about things like that.
The two-day White House Tribal Nations Summit concluded Thursday with topics ranging from veterans' issues to a special message from astronaut Nicole Mann, who's currently in space on a mission, the first Native American woman to go to space. The Interior Department is putting $75 million toward community relocation efforts for three tribes in Alaska and Washington State that are struggling with the consequences of a changing climate.
We've never really done anything like this before in this country, particularly for tribes.
Brian Newland is the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. He says the Interior Department hopes to capitalize on some of the progress Nutak Alaska has already made and develop a blueprint for the federal government's future response to climate change.
You know, we want to make sure that we are gaining experience on the federal side of things, working with tribes to do climate relocation work.
Newland says the department weighed a lot of factors in deciding how to allocate the money.
We evaluated a number of communities that have gone through some of our climate funding programs before, and we weighted a number of different factors like readiness, need, existing plans, as well as our ability to glean lessons learned.
The tribes will also receive funding from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Eight other tribes across the U.S. will share $40 million to assist in planning for climate change mitigation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Some might praise regenerative agriculture as a new phenomenon, but the techniques are older than the United States itself. Native farmers have long been pushed to the margin. They want newcomers to the world of non-industrial food production to know there's nothing novel about caring for the land that grows our food. Mike Moen has the details.
Regenerative agriculture is gaining attention under the umbrella of climate change. While it's often cited as a new trend, a Native American farmer in South Dakota says these techniques have indigenous origins, and she's helping to keep them alive. Historians say ranching was one reason settlers and colonizers began to claim land from Native populations west of the Mississippi in the mid-1800s. That eventually paved the way for things like factory farms. Now, mid- to smaller-scale producers are leading the push for sustainable practices. Kelsey Scott, an indigenous farmer near the Cheyenne River Reservation, acknowledges others are getting credit for the work of her ancestors.
It's not something brand new. It's just something that's getting marketed.
Scott's farm uses rotational grazing for cattle to help maintain a healthy soil. She likens it to back when herds of bison would avoid land the animals had previously grazed. And because she doesn't use chemicals, the animal waste can naturally fertilize the land in the way bison used to. That allows her farm to provide more healthier options directly to local natives. And Scott suggests her business is an expression of resiliency that existed in agriculture production prior to colonial impact. She adds the movement needs to keep an open mind about current conditions as well as the past.
In order to be the best land steward that you can, you have to get curious about what has happened on that land.
She feels that research and reflection should go even beyond when indigenous farmers began working these lands, noting ecological patterns before those times can also help paint a picture. A researcher with the Rodale Institute says regenerative agriculture only accounts for 10% of farms and ranches today, but the numbers are slowly increasing. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
Advocates have an idea that could help replenish California's groundwater supplies. Groundwater pumping during droughts is straining the state's underground aquifers, but this approach might help. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When drought strikes, California farmers often pump water from underground aquifers to water their crops. But increasingly dry conditions are straining that resource.
On average, over time, we have been extracting more water from the subsurface than has been recharged.
David Freiberg of Stanford University says many people are looking at ways to replenish the state's dwindling groundwater supplies. In California, a lot of water typically comes from winter snow that falls high in the mountains. During warmer months, that snow melts and trickles down to farmland. But as the climate warms, more precipitation is falling as rain instead of snow, so it rushes into rivers and runs past many areas where it's needed. Freiberg says one idea is to divert some of this water from the rivers and allow it to spread across farm fields.
So that it will infiltrate into the soil and move down into the places where there is groundwater, what are called aquifers.
He says before scaling up this approach, Researchers need to evaluate the best methods to use and the impacts on farms and water quality. But he says it's worth taking those steps because the idea holds promise. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 2nd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Alex Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagan, Eric Tegetoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Annette Newell. So glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, so now's a great time to get involved. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin coming up next.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, former Vice President Mike Pence recently said with a straight face that Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, was the most dangerous person in the world. It's not a close call, he said. If you ask who's the most likely to take this republic down, it would be the teachers' unions and the filth that they're teaching our kids. So that's more evidence where it needed that the current struggle for pay and dignity by teaching assistants and adjuncts and researchers at the University of California is really part of a bigger fight about whether educators at whatever level are actual workers and who is looking out for their rights. We'll hear from labor historian